Support for the Capital Connection comes from
United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm David Gustina. On this week's program, it's the incredible, talented, always in the know, Jimmy Vielkind, public media reporter at WNYC and the Gothamist, as well as the New York Public News Network. Welcome back, you multi-talented reporter, you, Jimmy Vielkind.
Thank you, David. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you here. Now, before we go any further, first of all, I hope you had a good holiday. I have some understanding that you did, because you wrote in your column that Santa brought you a record player.
That's right. So it's kind of cool. It's a modern record player that I can claim no credit for. My spouse brought this into our house. I didn't mean to rhyme there.
That's okay. It's holiday time. That's okay. What we do.
We can do it. And each of us got a record. I got In Rainbows by Radiohead. Some of the kids got some Taylor Swift and some Chappell Roan. And we had some records, but actually kind of the coolest thing about this is we went to my folks' house, and they have a very extensive record collection. One of my parents worked at their college radio station. I think some of those records may have been liberated from the station library. And so we felt in turn that we should liberate from the parental library.
Absolutely. Why
not?
Some
good stuff. And I'm hoping it'll be a cool way for the family to sit and maybe discover some music that you wouldn't necessarily stumble upon in the Spotify era.
We fooled around long enough. Now let's get to the real news.
Okay. The real news.
You've been writing about some new laws taking effect in New York. And one of them, which has been worked on for over 10 years, is the Medical Aid in Dying Act. Now, some call it assisted suicide, but it seemed like it was a big decision for the governor. She expressed that and gave her reasons why. And that legislation was worked on right up until the very end because the governor wanted some concessions, right, Jimmy?
Yeah, that's right. This is something that, as you said, David, has been around the state capitol for more than a decade. And its premise is simple: allow New York to join the dozen other states. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker also signed a law legalizing physician-assisted death, and essentially give people who are facing a terminal diagnosis, who are in the final months of their life, the ability to get assistance in acquiring some kind of lethal cocktail of drugs to do it on their own terms. And the argument for this is that it is empowering patients and it is compassionate for people who know they are going to die, who are experiencing considerable pain, who have no quality of life in the final days, weeks, or months of their time on earth, to let them essentially pick a time, pick a space, pick who they want to have around them and do it. So the premise of this has been relatively simple, but Governor Hochul talked about how she really wrestled with this legislation. It's a big one. Governor Hochul is Roman Catholic, and she weighed very heavily opposition from church leaders and from not just Catholic clergy, but other religious organizations and also other people who pointed out what they think will be lack of safeguards in this new law and also their fear that it will cause unintended consequences. The New York State Alliance Against Assisted Suicide essentially pointed out that they think this will change the nature of medicine, that doctors are trained to heal. They talk about how the American Medical Association, a national physician advocacy group, has in its code of ethics essentially cautioning against physician-assisted death and against these kinds of actions. Other medical groups in New York have said that they support this. They support it as a medical choice for patients. So it gets very murky very quickly. In the fall, Governor Hochul began to push for several changes to the legislation, which she thought would be additional safeguards on its use in New York. And some of them were relatively common sense, and some of them were a little bit unorthodox. So she wanted to enact a waiting period between when a patient can request this lethal dose of drugs and when they can be delivered by a medical professional. She wanted to broaden and expand the required mental health checks. Under the legislation as passed in June, there was a requirement that a physician attest to the fact that somebody had a terminal condition and less than 6 months to live. But unless they exhibited signs of a lack of mental alertness, there was not necessarily a mandatory mental health evaluation. under Hochul's strictures, there will be a mandatory evaluation by a psychologist or a psychiatrist. The bill would be restricted to New Yorkers. There would be a residency requirement for people who wish to come to New York and avail themselves of this procedure. And finally, and perhaps most controversially, there is a requirement that people make a video or audio message of themselves asking to end their life, which is part of their permanent medical record. That is a unique to New York requirement. It is something that does not exist in the other states that have legalized this practice. And so Hochul talked about this. She talked about her push for these new strictures. And she said that this really came down to the tension between individual rights and perhaps religious morality or various religions' frameworks of morality. And she said that New York has long had a tradition of siding with individual rights and empowering individuals, be it in the spirit of religious tolerance, going back to the Flushing Remonstrance under the Dutch, be it with LGBTQ rights, going back to the Stonewall riots, or be it with racial equality and the civil rights era. So in that framework, she decided to promise to sign the law. I don't think she's actually signed it yet, in exchange for these additional safeguards. So that procedure should be allowed in the state starting in the upcoming summer of 2026.
Well, Jimmy, let's move on to something else, which is prison reform. Now, this really took center stage after we saw the death at the hands of prison guards of Robert Brooks and Messiah Nantwi, who both didn't deserve the kind of death that they received. Obviously, that prompted the governor in part to push for prison reform, but you also have lots of problems that prison guards have complained about, including overcrowded prisons and other problems. But the issue is prison reform. We have this omnibus prison reform bill she signed, and then the issue of what I'm hearing is even more prison reform that they're going to push for the coming session.
That's right. This was a very salient issue for two reasons in 2025. The first, as you said, was actually something that happened in December of 2024, which was the murder of Robert Brooks at the hands of 10 state employees in the Marcy Correctional Facility just outside of Utica. So there's body camera video footage, which is quite graphic, which shows these guards punching, kicking, at one point holding the neck of Brooks while he's on a bed in an infirmary, essentially ending this man's life shortly after he arrived at Marcy from a nearby facility. So several of the guards implicated in that have been charged and pleaded guilty to serious felony offenses. One person was convicted of murder in connection with Brooks's death. And as the indictments of those officers was pending in February, the prison system went on strike. Guards launched an unauthorized 3-week wildcat strike, which started in Western New York, but spread all across the state. And it really laid bare the problems within New York's 42 prisons, problems for incarcerated people, problems for correctional officers who have to work there, and of course, problems for all New Yorkers who are ultimately responsible for this system that we use as a critical part of our criminal justice structures. And so after the strike, which prison reform advocates accused the strikers of trying to change the subject from the indictment of the guards in connection with Robert Brooks's death.
I think we have to admit, at the very least, the timing is suspect.
Well, the two happened at the same time. The strike began as the indictment was pending or as it was about to come down against these guards. So I can't speak to the strikers. Many of the strikers have said that this incident started and kind of boiled over out of frustration for a state law that was passed in 2021, which is the HALT Act, which limits the use of solitary confinement for incarcerated people in state prisons. Correctional officers argue that that removed an important disciplinary tool, and it has led to a rise in violence, both among incarcerated people and between incarcerated people and correctional officers within the state prison system. Advocates for that law say that's a whole bunch of hooey. They say that the law has never been fully implemented, but it has certainly put things from the perspective of correctional officers kind of to a breaking point. We know that as prisons get more violent, it becomes less desirable to work there. As it becomes less desirable to work there, fewer people take these jobs as correctional officers. As you have fewer officers, the people who remain have to work more. Then it gets harder for them. They want to leave. And you get this downward cycle that has created a real problem, which, again, boiled over in this 3-week unauthorized wildcat strike in February. So Governor Hochul has had to deploy National Guard personnel, thousands of whom still remain working in the state prison system, in order to fill these staffing gaps and in order to restore some semblance of order and structure and function to the state's prison facilities. So against all that backdrop, that entire backdrop, we have calls for reform, which again started in December of 2024 with Brooks's death, accelerated after the death of more incarcerated people during the strike, including Masaya Nantchui, who was allegedly beaten to death at a facility near where Brooks was murdered. And they came up with this omnibus bill, which passed in June. Now, it does several things. First, and I don't know if you could call this controversial, there was some back and forth on it. It requires the installation of cameras throughout the state prison system in so-called blind spots, where formerly incarcerated people and their advocates say that abuse often occurs. I think it's not perhaps a mistake that Brooks was beaten in the infirmary, a place where you don't typically think that there is going to be a fixed security camera. Second, it changes the scope and the makeup of the State Commission on Correction, which is the state's oversight body for the prison system. Currently, there are three members. Under the proposed legislation, it would have doubled to six members, one of whom was to have been a formerly incarcerated person. Under the compromise legislation that is apparently going to be coming into law after Governor Hochul signed it, there will be two additional part-time members, one of whom is to be a formerly incarcerated individual. So, and then there are also changes that would allow incarcerated people who have been abused in prisons to file lawsuits against the state after they are released from prison. Essentially, it's an extension of the statute of limitations on certain offenses and certain allegations of abuse. So I talked with State Senator Julia Salazar. She's a Democrat from Brooklyn who chairs the Chamber's Corrections Committee. And she said that while this isn't perfect, while this is a small step forward, she's happy to be stepping forward. And she also said that in 2026, she expects there will be additional legislation and additional measures that she hopes to implement in law.
We're speaking with Jimmy Vielkind, public media reporter at WNYC and The Gothamist, as well as the New York Public News Network. Jimmy, let's continue with more legislation, but something she repealed, which is the 100-foot rule. Explain that to our listeners.
So currently, if people want to have natural gas service installed at a new residence or a new business, if they're within 100 feet of an existing line, then that cost is covered by the utility, which means that it's socialized by people who are paying for gas service, paying for electrical service. The repeal of the 100-foot rule is something that was sought by environmental activists and advocates. And their argument is that you are having people subsidize the extension of natural gas, a fossil fuel that is contributing to climate change, and which they say is something that the state should be moving away from, that the state should be moving toward a greener future that is more reliable on sustainable energy and moving away from fossil fuels and also fossil fuel infrastructure. Opponents of this, including many Republicans, say that it increases costs, that it increases the costs for a new home construction at a time when you have a housing shortage in this state and where the cost of housing is rising out of the reach of many, that by doing this, you're essentially, if people want natural gas service, putting the cost upon the builder or the homeowner and essentially just increasing costs in a way that is contributing to an already unaffordable proposition. So Hochul agreed to repeal this rule with the caveat that it would wait a year. Now, is there something happening in 2026 that's different than 2025? Maybe in November, the first week of November, is there anything going on? Maybe an election. So I think that it was clear that the governor wanted to kick this past the election so that people didn't start feeling the effects until perhaps after voters have gone to the polls.
Yeah, and the issue of energy costs is huge, not just in New York, it's all across the country. And you see these approvals by the Public Service Commission for rate hikes as the governor was talking about her affordability agenda. Now, this is going to cost customers this hookup more money because they're going to charge them for these hookups. So there you go, more money coming out of my pocket, so to speak. So it seems to me that by kicking it down the road a year, they have time in the legislature to come up with some other energy alternatives or ways of helping the consumer.
Yeah, I was speaking with some Republican lawmakers this week who say that they really intend to push on this point in 2026. They intend to argue that some of the laws that were enacted by Democrats in recent years have contributed to an increase in costs on the energy front. And also some mandates like the requirement that school districts shift to electric buses that are not perfectly feasible at times and come with an amount of cost that taxpayers are blanching at in some ways. Democrats, of course, argue that this is necessary, that over the long term, this is cost effective, and to say nothing of the fact that the climate is changing, the burning of fossil fuels contributes to climate change, and New York State has decided and adopted policies to reduce fossil fuel use and increase reliance on renewable energy. So something that I think we will be hearing a lot about in 2026.
Well, yeah, and not to mention that the federal government has basically pulled the pin on the grenade and dropped it into the environmental legislation in many states because of what's been happening with the EPA and your former Congressman Lee Zeldin, the head there, and they're rolling back all the regulations. They're not putting in regulations, which you would think a regulatory agency would do. So it's no wonder that the HEAT Act and some of these other proposals have been scuttled and really haven't formed like they wanted them to in New York.
Yeah, you know, it is increasingly clear that state policies that were enacted are no longer moving in harmony with federal policies since President Trump was reelected.
Absolutely. Well, let's get to a veto, an actual veto here, a measure that would have required mental health leave for state troopers who engage in critical incidents. How come that was vetoed?
You know, Governor Hochul said that she was concerned about the cost and she was concerned about the staffing implications this would have for the New York State Police. That was kind of a common theme with many of the bills that she put under her veto pen. There are laws that get passed all the time outside of the state's normal budget process, which say you have to do this, you have to create a commission, you have to do a study, you have to appoint a member, blah, 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 blah. And when they have costs that aren't necessarily accounted for in the budget, usually you're heading for a veto pen. Now, proponents of this measure, including the New York State Troopers Police Benevolent Association, say that it doesn't necessarily have an increased costs and that supervisors should be able to manage the personnel flow. And in fact, they pointed to a modification in the legislation before it was passed that that gave additional flexibility to the state police to schedule the mandatory mental health leave of state troopers who are involved in critical incidents. And I should say critical incidents are defined by anything that results in the death or serious injury of another person, be that a subject, a person who's interacting with the police, or a police officer themselves. And so that was Hochul's rationale. The union wasn't happy about it. We'll have to see what program, if anything, gets baked into her budget, or if this law is going to be considered again. It's a law, David, that passed with, I think, one dissenting vote in both the state assembly and the Senate. So clearly there's some bipartisan support.
Yeah, I would say. Well, Jimmy, I want to ask you about something that's been being tested in the schools. And I know that you're aware of how important cell phones are to us and our jobs. But when it comes to learning in schools and use of the cell phone and social media, we've seen lots of problems, including mental health problems. And so the schools, at the behest of the governor, have a cell phone ban now. And some of that anecdotal evidence coming out of there says it's been a boost. It's been helpful. We've seen it in other places doing good. What have you been hearing?
I've read those same anecdotes and talking to friends who are educators, talking to people who lead school districts, and talking to lawmakers. It does seem to have had its intended effect. Having a statewide policy and essentially having the state government be the one who stepped in and said no was a relief. Lots of school districts wanted to see this. They recognized that the use of cell phones during the school day was causing problems, but they didn't want to be the bad guy. They didn't want to face angry parents. So having this be a state law, I think, caused a sigh of relief among many, many school leaders who have all reported an increase in engagement, an increase in perhaps student participation in extracurricular activities. They've reported a decrease in classroom disruptions. So I think the only people who may have some negative feelings, or the constituency that may feel the most negatively about this, are the students themselves. So to both of our teenage listeners, tough.
Yeah, right. We're still in charge for now. But the other part that I heard is that, you know, because the schools have been able to look at their own population, they have also been able to make some accommodations for people with disabilities and others. So the idea of this statewide mandate, but also that the schools are working within their own populations to work it all out. And hopefully we'll continue to see those good reports coming back. Boy, we're running out of time. Jimmy Vielkind on this week's Capital Connection. Probably the biggest story of the year came at the very end was Elise Stefanik, the congresswoman from New York, who was going to be ambassador, then not ambassador, who was going to run for governor of New York, then was going to face a challenge, and then didn't really get an endorsement from the president and sort of lukewarm. And now she says, not only am I out of the governor's race, but I'm going to end my term and be out of politics. That's a pretty big shocker.
Yeah, this is something that, you're right, had been slow boiling for quite some time. And, you know, I think as you just laid out, there are lots of reasons for any person who has gone through the path and the 2025 that Elise Stefanik has to be very frustrated. So it's clear that she was frustrated when her nomination to the United Nations was scuttled, because essentially Republicans in the House of Representatives have such a thin margin that either the concern that the GOP would lose her North Country congressional seat, that's the 21st district, it would be my guess that the Republicans would have still held on to it, but just the fact that it would have been vacant for some period of time between her resignation from Congress and when an election can be held and a new person can be seated, that was a problem for Republican leaders who are really operating on a razor's edge in the House of Representatives. So she was back in Congress and, you know, frustrated in that regard. Frustrated at House leadership. She's made very clear her frustration at House Speaker Mike Johnson, the Republican from Louisiana, and, you know, started talking and thinking more seriously about running for governor over the summer. Now, she cleared what seemed to have been a major hurdle with that over the summer when Representative Mike Lawler of the Lower Hudson Valley announced that he would not run a campaign for governor. So potentially avoiding what would have been a very contentious and messy primary between two Republicans in the state who have very, very high profiles. So it looked like things were smooth sailing for Stefanik. And sure enough, right after the polls closed on Election Day this year, she announced a campaign with a tour de force of supporters. Even Lawler, her one-time rival, endorsed her in an event. You saw Republican Party officials from Buffalo to Brooklyn line up behind her bid. Donor support poured in. But as you said, David, there was one person who didn't quite get on board, and that was President Trump. That's surprising because Stefanik, while she was first elected as a more moderate Republican in 2014, has really become one of President Trump's staunchest defenders in Congress. She was on his defense team during his impeachment. And to not get his explicit blessing, I think, must have landed as a blow. And when that happened, it gave an opening for Nassau County Executive Bruce Blakeman, who won a resounding re-election in November of this year, a rare red spot in what was otherwise a pretty good night for Democrats across the country. So Blakeman, with a very powerful base in Nassau County, one of the state's most populous counties, said that he would explore a bid for governor. And then he announced his candidacy for governor. And it was against that backdrop, against all these frustrations, that Stefanik said, you know what, I would have won this primary, but doing so is going to cost resources. It was always going to be an uphill task for a Republican to defeat Kathy Hochul in a state where there are twice as many enrolled Democrats as there are Republicans.
And don't forget that the president of the United States has a past with Bruce Blakeman. They're former businessmen. They've known each other for a long time. And when he announced he was going to get in, he said, well, quote, I like both of them.
That's right. And so Stefanik, facing this possibility of having to deal with this primary that she wasn't expecting to, said she was done. She stated that The primary was a consideration, but also that she wanted to spend more time with her young son, who turned 4 in August. So I don't think this is the last we've heard of Elise Stefanik. Mm. She's a relatively young person, 41 years old, and she clearly has exhibited an interest in the public conversation and an ambition to insert herself and to be part of it. So I don't think this is the last we'll hear from her, and we will see what the next chapter for her holds.
One thing we haven't mentioned here is Zohran Mamdani, who won the mayor's race in New York City, a Democratic Socialist who, now let's stick with Stefanik for a second. Stefanik was hammering and calling a jihadist and is hitting him as hard as she could. And then Mamdani wins, goes to the White House, and is greeted very nicely by the president of the United States, asked about whether he considers him a jihadist. No. And, you know, he's a smart man, basically. They agreed with each other that they could work together. So that was another slight there. But now you have the prospect of Mamdani, a Democratic Socialist, now has to govern in New York City and at some point come hat in hand to Albany for the money.
That's right. And I think one of the major themes of 2026 will be watching how Zohran Mamdani, an ascendant figure in the left flank of the Democratic Party, deals with the moderates who control the state legislature, particularly Kathy Hochul. Now, Kathy Hochul endorsed Mamdani. She is facing a Democratic primary challenge for her own reelection effort in 2026. And so the question is, how much of Mamdani's agenda will Hochul acquiesce to? One of the big questions that I'll be watching very closely is raising taxes in the state. So Mamdani has proposed multiple efforts that will cost lots of money, including a massive expansion of child care subsidies and a push to make buses fare free in New York City. He wants to fund them by taxing the rich, by taxing millionaires. So Hochul has said she does not want to raise income taxes on the wealthiest New Yorkers. Will they find another way to circle that square? I think it's going to be very interesting. It's going to be something we'll be talking about in the coming months.
Let's keep the phrase revenue raisers in mind. He is Jimmy Vielkind. What a pleasure always to speak with you, Jimmy. It's time to get your New Year celebrations in now, Jimmy, because it's going to get busy. Happy New Year, sir.
Cheers.
Support for the Capital Connection comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.